You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
With all that being said, it's now time for Who Will Slay the Elbit Beast.
You know, you could have stayed at home that night in 2024. By now, you'd be in second year at uni, maybe with a girlfriend and a job, instead of 18 months in prison and an electronic tag. You could have done what everybody else did, just scrolled on by, found a different reel to watch, turned your face away, and got on with your life. You didn't have to take up arms, especially those pale and skinny arms, against a genocide. Welcome, everyone. Thank you all for coming. There's about, we're expecting about 10 people, so this is a nice turnout. I'm Claire Hinchcliffe. Early one morning, 2 years ago, four police officers came to my door with the news that my daughter, Joey, then 20 years old, was being detained in a Bristol police station. It turned out that she'd been arrested inside a facility belonging to Israeli factory Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, in Filton near Bristol, along with other Palestine Action activists. The police told me I'd get a call from her in about 24 hours. That call never came. Because she is one of the Filton 25, the first pro-Palestine activists in this country that this government has used counter-terror powers against, thanks to lobbying from Israel and from Elbit Systems. The activists were held for 7 days in a terrorist detention suite. They were interrogated day and night. They were not allowed to make a single phone call to tell their loved ones where they were. They then appeared briefly in Westminster Magistrates Court after that first week. They were denied bail. They were remanded to prison. Seeing her from the public gallery, it was the first time I had seen my daughter in a week. And watching her being led out of that courtroom was one of the hardest moments of my life. My life was turned upside down. And one of the ways I cope with that was to write poems. Playing on a loop inside my mind is my daughter being led out of that courtroom and the door that slams behind. Whoever thought that locking up the ones we love would make the world a better place? Or that bars and guards and toughened glass could keep our hearts at bay? They don't know that even if they block the calls, the visits and the mail, and if all the gifts we send get lost somewhere in the jail, love will get in anyway. Love squeezes through the gaps between the breeze blocks and barbed wire, the cameras and the doors, the warden's callous consciences and souls. The cracks within the whole vile, godforsaken system, arriving scraped and bleeding in our loved ones' cells. Love always finds a way, but oh, it hurts. It hurts like hell. Thank you. I see them as I cycle past. He is tiny, balance bike, maybe his first ever ride. She is striding close behind, breathless with anxiety and pride. I bet her heart soars for him. I bet her heart stops for him. She wants him to be safe, but she wants him to be free. I remember how that feels, the first time their wheels turn, their feet lift off the ground. You run behind, you call to them, not too fast, not too far. Oh no, car coming, come back here to me. Your heart soars for them, your heart stops for them. You want to make them safe, but you want them to be free. That is how I'm feeling now. My daughter took a hammer to Israel's war machine, raised it with her matchstick arms and smashed the drones to smithereens. My heart soars for her. My heart stops for her. I want to make her safe, but I want her to be free. I wasn't there. I couldn't say, not too fast or not too far, or oh no, police coming. Come back here to me. I cannot make her safe now. They've taken her from me. But I know that in there somewhere, she is free. As soon as the activists were arrested, the police put out a statement about the action in Filton. They said the activists were carrying weapons, that they were violent, that they had attacked and injured a police officer. They said nothing of the violence of the Elbit security guards, which created the panic in which Sam Corner mistakenly hit a police officer while trying to protect another activist. Or that the place they'd broken into was an Israeli weapons factory. Or that the activists were in fact carrying tools, and what they used their tools to dismantle were weapons awaiting export to Israel, breaking domestic and international laws. The press picked up on the police statement and the headlines were terrible. Later, Yvette Cooper, as Home Secretary, repeatedly used this misreporting of the action before the evidence had gone to trial, committing contempt of court, to justify the proscription of Palestine action. We started encouraging the prisoners to write their own statements and to make their own narrative. So Jerry wrote a statement about why she had taken action, and she read it to me over the phone from HMP Bronzefield in Surrey. And I said, Jerry, that's not a statement, that's a poem. And we want to share that poem with you, and I think the best person to read it to you is Jerry. Please welcome to the stage, Jerry Hinchcliffe.
When they ask me why I did it, I tell them about the children. How their childhoods are stolen from them. How their skeletons are left, charred and smoking. How easily their bodies are crushed by falling buildings. How their skin melts as their flaming tents collapse around them. I tell them of the boy found carrying his brother's body inside his bloody backpack. I tell them of the girl whose hanging corpse ended at the knees. I tell them of the father holding up his headless toddler. I tell them of the mother who received the approximate weight of her family in body parts to bury as they had all been shattered beyond recognition. Then I tell them about the history, how this has happened time and time again. I tell them about the Stern Gang, the Hilltop Youth, the wars of 48 and 67, and of Operation Cast Lead. I explain how they call it mowing the lawn, cleaning the land of these human animals, how they calculate the minimum nutrients to keep everyone alive, chop a bit off, and let only that inside. Finally, I tell them it was us that started it, with our Balfour Declaration and our media suppression. And so I said, I cannot stand for this. It can go on no longer. And I took action against Elbit, their biggest weapon supplier. But I never forget to say that it was love, not hate, that called me. Watching their songs and dances of freedom, reading their hope-filled books, listening to their dreams of being doctors, teachers, journalists, and never giving up. Hello, I'm Joey Hinchcliffe, one of six activists who broke into Elbit Systems' biggest site in Bristol, taking direct action against the Israeli arms trade. Woo. Direct action is commonly misunderstood as a form of protest, but it's actually very different. And there's a great quote from David Graeber that explains it. So protest is like begging the powers that be to dig you a well. Direct action is digging the well yourself and daring them to stop you. And in this situation, the government had failed to stop the export of weapons to Israel, refusing to comply with international law. And so we decided we had to take direct action and do it ourselves. To get inside, we used a repurposed prison van to drive through two fences and the shutters of the factory. Inside, we found dozens of surveillance and killer drones packed up ready for export to Israel. And in the 20 minutes it took for the police to arrive, we destroyed 40 weapons, causing over $1 million in damages. So I'm guessing you guys have probably heard of Elbit Systems before? Yeah. Just to make sure everybody's on the same page, I've got three not very fun facts about Elbit Systems. So, one, Elbit Systems provides 85% of Israel's military drones and land-based equipment. Two, they boast that their drones are battle-tested on Palestinians and that their drones are used in every major operation in the Gaza Strip. So not only are these drones used to hunt down and murder journalists, not only are they used to pick off survivors of bombings, not only are they used to shoot hungry parents waiting for flour to feed their children, but they are used to oversee the smooth operation of genocide across the whole of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military could not function without them. Three, these drones are manufactured right here in the UK, in our cities such as Leicester and Bristol, in complete violation of both UK and international law. And so far, the only effective means of shutting them down has not been court cases or petitions, strongly worded statements or protests, but ordinary people taking direct action against them.
So in those early days following Joey's arrest, to be completely honest, I felt a little bit uncomfortable about what she'd been involved in, especially as a Christian. And I had to work out, what do I think about what she's done? Weren't they breaking the law? Isn't property damage with sledgehammers a little bit violent? But every time I prayed, what came into my mind was Jesus turning over the tables in the temple. And I began to see sometimes justice gets angry. And then the more I thought about it, here are people throwing their bodies into the Israeli war machine, putting themselves at great personal risk to get between weapons and the men, women, and children they are designed to kill. And I began to think, actually, what could be more like Christ? And I also heard about Christians who've taken direct action in the past and in the present. One that springs to mind is a priest in America, Daniel Berrigan, during the Vietnam War, who also took direct action. And then I began to learn about the evils of the arms trade, Elbit, and others, and the corruption that these organisations, the profits, the corruption that it sows in governments around the world. It's just repulsive and shocking. And someone who opened my eyes was Andrew Feinstein. If you can listen to him on YouTube, it's very educational. You can watch a film on YouTube called The Shadow World, which just opened my eyes to the arms trade evils. And I started to see these guys who had taken direct action. The six who went to the factory were all under 30, and parents were in the support group, like myself. And I kind of saw them as like really brave children breaking into the lairs of this disgusting beast and bravely poking it with their sticks, you know, just doing anything that they could. And that picture turned into this poem, which is called Who Will Slay the Elbit Beast? Where did it come from, this vile thing? It must have crawled out of the North Atlantic depths while we were all asleep. And now it's here, growing viler and more bloated by the year. And while it's too disgusting to describe, I can tell you there's an orifice beneath its tail that pumps out bombs and drones and piles of stinking cash for anyone who can stand the smell. Its face is too hideous to see. Think of something like a baby's brain hanging from its bombed out skull. But we don't have to look at it. It's screened off behind the shiny websites, offices and names. Lockheed Martin, Rafael, British Aerospace, and Elbit Systems, Pride of Israel, offering solutions, security, and of course, defence, and other polished forms of deadly excrement. It's groomed and fed by the billionaires it's made and the politicians it controls. It has many, many mouths, and as each one shrieks for more, ministers disembowel their budgets and feed it with our money that was intended for the poor. When they meet behind closed doors, world leaders aren't discussing security or peace. They're only middle-ranking sales reps doing deals for the beast. What does this creature want from us? A world of endless war, austerity and death, ruled by a handful of the super rich? Do this chosen few not realise that when the ship goes down, the beast will feast on their flesh too? Who will slay this monster? The long arc of the universe bends in unexpected ways, bringing justice, not through politicians, judges or police, but through our children, armed with not much more than courage and outrageous love, who go into the monster's lairs, poke it with their sticks, pull its tail and crack its teeth. They get rounded up, arrested and detained, but more of them return in waves. It doesn't matter that this monster meets weekly with police, or that puppets in their wigs and gowns call them terrorists and send them down. The authorities cannot compete with those who don't fear prison if a child's life is saved. And each time it's poked, the monster roars and rises up, so at last its belly, swollen with the blood of innocence, becomes exposed to public view and ends all talk of self-defence. One day in the future, when its rotted corpse has long been thrown back in the sea, they will know it was our children. They will say it was our children. They will sing about our children who slain the Elbit beast.
Six arrests soon became 10, then 18, 24, and finally we were left with the Filton 25. People were rounded up in dawn raids by counter-terror police, had their home doors smashed in, guns pointed at their heads, their families handcuffed in their homes, including their children. All of this was done under the Terrorism Act, a piece of legislation designed to revoke people's human rights, all under the justification of national security. We were then kept in prison for up to 18 months without trial, three times the legal limit for unconvicted prisoners. And before my trial even began, before a single piece of evidence had been heard, our legal defences had been ruled out and a terrorism connection was applied. If the jury found us guilty of criminal damage, we would be sentenced as terrorists. We knew that the state was trying to make an example out of us, trying to dissuade other people from taking action and break our spirits too. But as Heber Morisi, one of the Filton 25, says, those cages they love to throw us in, they're only as small as we let them be. And that was the attitude we took into our court hearings and our trial.
This poem is called Plea Hearing for the Filton 18. After the door of the Old Bailey, the x-ray, metal detector, manual search, and being told to leave my phone outside, I start to climb the stairs, and the drums and chanting on the street below begin to fade. Then the waiting room and the po-faced guard who leads us to the gallery above the court, who says whispering or pointing will get us taken out. And below us is a scene from a courtroom drama, complete with wigs and judge, but without subtitles, and I don't speak legalese. Where is my daughter and the other 17? A noise starts up from a screen beneath and out of sight. A video link is whistling and shrieking from the bellies of the prisons where they're held. Then the 18 names are read, and one by one they answer, yes. And suddenly they're with us, in the room. We parents catch each other's eyes and smile. More legalese and shoes. Adjoining, serving evidence, time limits, crown, arraigned. His wig is on skew-whiff. I wonder if he knows. I reckon she's had Botox. And the judge tells someone she is not impressed with something, but looks like Father Christmas in that cloak. Then the court clerk reads out words we all can understand, the charges, and again their names, how do you plead? The video squeals back to life, and after every name we hear two words wing into the room, not guilty, not guilty. And the clerk repeats each one, not guilty, not guilty. And between these there is muffled laughter from the prison bowels. I watch the ceiling of the courtroom where the not guilties and the laughter chase one another round, swooping over legal heads, plucking playfully at wigs, riffling the papers in the judge's hands before coming back to land behind their bars just because they can. Thank you.
As the 15-month mark in prison was coming up, I was doing my best to prepare for trial. It was all I could talk about with my co-defendants, and I was terrified as I'd never spoken in public before. So we would spend our limited gym time trying to train me to project my voice just across the table tennis table. For our next court hearing, I asked to go in person to do a practice run for trial. And so, through the square window of the prison van, I saw the world beyond the prison walls for the first time in a year. And I wrote a poem about it. It's called 5 Inches from Freedom. Was I so lost that I believed a tiny patch of grass could substitute this varied, sprawling green, this endless sky? How could I forget that things could be so far away, could look so small? I'd forgotten that walls could grow, thick with ivy, begin to crumble. And when I lean my head down to my knees, I can fill my square with blue and ask, through double-layered one-way glass, were there always this many clouds?
I had to fight so hard to get her to include that poem. Isn't it beautiful? This one is called Looming. The trial is looming, is what I say now when people ask about my daughter, the one in prison. Looming is the word I always use. And suddenly I see it, towering above us, a frame that must be 12 foot high, taut threads stretching upwards into darkness, waiting for my daughter and her friends the way a scaffold waits. The warp is ready. They will be the weft. Shuttled back and forth by prison van, woken up at 5, 2 hours journey either side. Shuttled in and out of van and dock and cell, the prosecution's icy fingers forcing in and out of what and when and why. The wigs and gowns and 12 blank faces bearing down, back to prison in the van, up again at 5. The heavy grip of boredom, the sudden spikes of fear. But then, maybe 10 weeks later, it will be done. It will stand there in the courtroom where everyone can see their stories and their lives pulled in, pulled out, pressed down between the bars of 18 months in prison and the trials of the trial. May their colours blend and bleed into a weave of courage drawn by love, a portrait of these souls who valued far above themselves those crushed beneath a genocide. When that tapestry is seen, it almost doesn't matter what the jury will decide. Thank you. Throughout this grueling 2 years, God has never been absent for me. I'm a Christian in the Celtic tradition. I belong to the community of Aidan and Hilda. And what I've learned from that tradition is to see God in everything and to trust in God's justice. And I believe God's justice is very different to the justice of the what we call the British injustice system. And if I can paraphrase Maddie Norman, who's one of the Filton 25, she says, justice is not something that's going to be served to us from this corrupt government. It's something that we carry in our hearts. It's something that we carry out with our own bodies. And she finished by saying, I believe that justice was served on the 6th of August, 2024, in that Filton factory. As the trial wore on, and it was at least 10 weeks, and we were waiting for the jury to return their verdict for weeks, my bike rides to the court, Willis Crown Courts, prepared me. It was a beautiful bike ride. I got to be in nature, and they just prepared me for the tension that we were enduring every day. And inevitably, I wrote a poem. It's called If the Verdict Comes Today. I come to Woolwich Court by bike, over the bridge at Albert Wharf, then Woolwich Ferry to the other side. So if a verdict comes today, heavy, hard, unstoppable as freight, I will close my eyes and think about the cormorant spreading out its wings to dry, the ferry engine thrumming underfoot, the water and the vast, unending reaches of the sky.
After 10 long weeks, the verdicts finally came. The jury had refused to convict us of anything, a frequent outcome in Palestine Action trials, and had acquitted us on the most serious charges. The prosecution instantly announced a retrial via the unusual channel of Twitter, and we were thrown back into the court system once again, this time with even more restrictions on what we could say in court, and having watched the judge bring unprecedented contempt of court proceedings against the lead barrister, Rajiv Menon, on our trial, simply for defending his client. Needless to say, we were all terrified. The judge had effectively gagged our barristers, so five of us decided to do our own closing speeches. And here are some extracts from my speech to the jury. During this trial, you've heard some very important evidence. You've heard that there are factories on British soil making weapons to send to Israel. You've heard that the drones they make include Thor VTOL quadcopters used to drop grenades, drones that are advertised as battle-tested on Palestinians. You've heard that drones use AI to target children, and that Magni X surveillance drones work in tandem with killer drones, and that research and development carried out in the UK is vital to the Israeli military. You've also heard that the Bristol site was opened by the Israeli ambassador, that it has export licenses to Israel, and that Elba itself is the backbone of the Israeli military. You heard how we tried every democratic means available to us, and how none of it worked. You heard how direct action is effective, how it's being used to shut down weapons factories, four of which have been permanently closed. The prosecution know full well that we are right that this factory is supplying weapons to Israel to be used in Gaza. That is why they have chosen to suppress the truth rather than contest it. The prosecution have decided that the legality of Israel's actions is irrelevant in this trial, because they know you could not in good conscience find us guilty of anything if you were allowed to know the full truth. The reason I was willing and confident enough to get arrested was because I knew that now, 20 months in the future, I would be standing in front of 12 ordinary people like you. Not politicians, not legal experts, not a judge wearing 400-year-old horsehair on his head, but a panel of my equals. You are the best counterweight to power and tyranny in the legal system as it exists today. It is a privilege to be judged by you. I want you to know, however, that whatever you decide, I won't hold it against you. How can I when you've been kept so in the dark? But there's one thing you can be sure of. I am proud. I am so proud I took part in this. I am proud I overcame my fear and took action. Because of course I was scared. You don't just break into an Israeli weapons factory for fun. And I can say with absolute certainty that this is the best thing I have ever done, because there is a good chance that because of our actions that night, people's lives were saved. You know that we have been treated as though we are terrorists throughout this process. We are a domestic violence worker, two nursery school teachers, an Oxford student, an artist, and me. It sounds dystopian, but it's true, just like the prescription of Palestine Action. But this time, you guys are the decision makers. Unlike what the prosecution and the government would have you believe, you are not a rubber stamp. Do not fall into their trap. Find the six of us not guilty of criminal damage.
There was not a dry eye in the public gallery, as I'm sure you can imagine. All five of them gave incredibly moving speeches. And their barristers, who sat to one side in their normal clothes, they just sat on looking from the sidelines like proud parents at like a parents' evening at school. So that was a retrial. And at the end of that retrial, the jury returned their verdicts. And those verdicts were very strange. We think some jurors wanted to acquit all of them and some jurors wanted to convict all of them. And they did some kind of weird deal in that jury room. So they acquitted two of them and they convicted four. Joey and Jordan were acquitted. And clearly, the fact that they acquitted anyone shows that at least some jurors didn't believe that the damage they did was criminal at all. But Sam, Fatima, Zainab, Ellie and Lottie were all convicted of criminal damage. And Sam was convicted also of GBH without intent. And they were sent literally 30 minutes within their conviction. They were remanded back to prison to await sentencing, having already spent 18 months there. And what the jury didn't know when they convicted them was that although they were convicted of criminal damage, they would be sentenced as terrorists. That was kept secret from them. The day of the convictions was absolutely devastating. We have not shared a single moment of joy about the acquittals at all. We can't find it in our hearts because our loved ones effectively are back in prison. But that morning, I've been watching a nest cam of a peregrine falcon nest in Woking. I've been watching it for weeks on my phone. And that morning, There were two empty eggshells by the nest. The first chick had hatched. And I have hung on to that little sign of hope. And what I feel that it's telling me is that those four who were sent back to prison and then sentenced as terrorists, they are not defeated. They are prisoners of hope. And so I wrote a poem. And it's called, I Refuse to Say They Are in Prison. I refuse to say they are in prison. No, they are only hidden from us for a while, nested underneath the warm, dark, brooding feathers of their own outrageous hope. I refuse to say they're serving time. No, time is serving them, forming them within their shells, strengthening their wings, their souls. I refuse to say they will have sentences. No, they will have verses, and they will write them on the sky when they finally emerge.
Thank you. I became very close to the four people who are in prison throughout imprisonment and trial, so I'll just tell you a little bit about them. Lottie has spent her whole life fighting injustice. From volunteering in the Calais jungle, documenting police violence, to helping house survivors of domestic violence, she cares deeply about the people around her. Ellie is a musician, a regenerative farmer, and generally one of the funniest people I know. While in prison, she was a rock for others, writing guides for new prisoners and making us laugh even on the hardest days. I don't know Sam well, but my impression of him across two trials is that he's caring, selfless, funny, and very nerdy. He spent most of both trials constructing a new language in his legal notebook. And Fatima Zainab is a poet, a teacher, and a university student, and I am honoured to be able to call her my best friend. Between them, they were sentenced to over 25 years in prison. They are kept in higher security conditions than the average prisoner and have very limited contact with the outside world. I'm often asked, what can I do to support those in prison? And you can donate to the Prisoner Fund or write them letters. But for me, the best days in prison were hearing about how people on the outside were still taking action, how what had happened to us hadn't scared people but inspired them, how despite our imprisonment, factories were still being closed down, and that the supply of weapons to Israel would eventually stop. So I'll finish with a poem written by Fatima Zainab. There's a chant that goes, one, we are the people, two, we won't be silenced, three, stop the bombing now, 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 now. This poem is written around that chant. It's called We Are the People. One, we are the people. Glued to your roads and scaling your towers, locked into your prisons and marching down your streets. We, the people in common cause. We, the people, defenders of your democracy. We, the people, guardians of your conscience. Two, we won't be silenced. Not in the face of state-funded abusive police power as you arrest us in coffee shops and in our homes and in the process of dismantling your tools of murder. As you load us into your Serco vans while every piece of your bloodied machine is invested in the business of mass slaughter. In the interests of your so-called diplomacy that blinds your eyes to war crimes. In your heavied pockets loaded by lobbyists while you cut our welfare and spend it on killing kids instead. Three, stop the bombing. No more illegal invasion swept under the rug. No more sanitized history lessons where you pretend colonialism was a conquest of victory and your theft was a gift giving willingly and your gunboat was separate from your diplomacy. No more bloody cycles. No more surveillance state. No more pretending you're not coming for us next. No more. We the people want no more. We the people know none of us are free until all of us are free. We the people demand it. Now, 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 now.
We've come to the end of everything we were going to say and read out. We thought you probably would have a few questions for us. So we'd like to give some time now to questions, ask anything you like. Just to also say to you, you'll see some QR code posters. There's two different QR codes, three actually. One is the Filton 25 website. I don't know if you want, if you're interested in that, you can go and look, you can sign up to the mailing list. There have been two Filton 25 trials so far. There are two to go because there's so many of them. And the next one, trial three, starts in September. So you might want to sign up to the mailing list. You'll get weekly updates written mainly by me on what's going on. In case your phone, the internet's not working, look up filtonactionists.com if that QR code doesn't work. There's also a QR code that says learn about direct action. If the internet doesn't work for you with that QR code, look up directactiontraining.org and you can see what that's all about. Also, there's a QR code for a T-shirt. Now, something that Jerry didn't mention was that when Ellie Cameo was led out of the courtroom, having been sentenced as a terrorist, she said into her microphone, she paraphrased the words of a Palestinian poet, and I'm going to get his name wrong. Someone else will tell you his name. And she said, to hear the birds, the drones must be silent. And Philippa, who's from my church, has made a beautiful T-shirt that has that. Jerry might be modelling it later. And there's a QR code to order that T-shirt from the website. So I think we're just going to take any questions. We've got a roving mic. Thanks, Naomi. Do you want to just, set your hands up and go for it? Naomi's going to hold on to the mic. So, and if you could keep them short and try to ask questions rather than statements. Thanks.
Thank you. And just a reminder as well that the question and answers will also be part of the recorded talk.
Hiya, that was amazing. Thank you so much. This is a question for Joey. So there are different levels of direct action. There's everything from like locking on to gluing yourself to a building to doing what you did, criminal damage and breaking in. I wondered if there was a moment when you realized that doing a lock on or something like that wasn't enough and you needed to actually go inside and destroy these death machines.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, cool. Okay. I think for me, I just always wanted to do the most that I could. But it's obviously a very different situation now. So if you did the action I did now, you would have a terrorist connection. people tend to choose to do lock-ons now, or rooftop occupations to avoid the terrorist connection, and those are just as effective. But all actions are effective and help shut down the weapons trade, I think. Yeah.
Just to add to that, I think direct action has been phenomenally successful in this country, more so than we realise. I was really struck by the fact, and just the relentlessness of it, you know, breaking windows of Barclays Bank so that Barclays dropped Elbit, stopped insuring Elbit, countless things like that. It's raised Elbit's operational costs in this country. In 2024, Elbit Systems UK made a massive loss for the first time in its history. That direct action does work. Any other questions?
Hello, yes, thank you. Very impressed. I'm just wondering, do you not have a criminal record?
Me? No, yeah. I don't.
Oh, good. Excellent. Ah, that's good news, isn't it? And so, can you manage your daily life as a student? I can't remember now if you're still at university.
Not a student. I'm starting an internship. But yeah, no, I don't have any legal proceedings against me currently. But most of the Filton 25 do and are awaiting trial or have been sentenced.
Do you want to say more about terrorists and the effects of the terrorists?
I'm just asking Jerry to talk a bit more about the fact, the effects on their lives, even after they've been released from prison, of those, if the terrorist sentencing is not, if appeal isn't successful, what will happen?
So when you're convicted of terrorism, even under the terrorism connection, after release, you're put on something called notification, which essentially means that you'll be monitored by the state for anywhere between 5 years to the rest of your life. And it means you have to tell the police about every email account that you make, every bank account, every relationship, every home address, if you're going on holiday. And for Fatima Zain and for any Muslim people who have been sentenced, they'll also have to tell the state about the mosque that they're going to. Usually it'll be picked out by the state and they won't be able to talk to anybody else. And if anyone makes a mistake, or if the government just decides that they think you've made a mistake, you could be sent back to prison for another 5 years. So it's pretty bad.
I just wanted to highlight that because we really need to fight this terrorism connection. There's very good reason why we need to actually fight the whole Terrorism Act, and that's another story that Jerry's more eloquent about than I am. But to use counter-terror powers against activists is completely unprecedented. And we are sleepwalking into a police state here. This is not something we can take lying down. Rajiv Menon, KC, who gave an incredible closing speech in the first trial, is undergoing contempt of court proceedings. It's all part of the same machinery from the state. All of this expense, all of this political power to protect an Israeli weapons manufacturer. That is what it's for, to protect their relationship with Israel, who are committing a genocide, who we shouldn't be doing any business with at all. It's something we need to really be vocal about. Even for those who can't or don't want to take direct action, we can raise an absolute stink about the abuse of state power. Any other questions? Oh, by the way, I should say, just so you're not all completely depressed, it is being appealed. It's being appealed. And we will eventually win this appeal on the terrorist sentencing. It might take longer than it does for them to get out of prison, but it will go up through all the courts, all the way to the European Court of Human Rights, and ultimately it should be successful. Sorry, any other questions?
Sorry, I appreciate I could Google this and put more effort into research, but I thought I read an article that said Palestine Action, their terrorism prescription was removed, so I don't really understand what's happened there.
Shall I explain? So it's been swings and roundabouts. So it was found to be unlawful, the prescription of Palestine Action, back in February. February was a good month because they all got off from the first trial. They were released from prison on bail And then it was found to be unlawful to have proscribed Palestine action. And then it went to the Court of Appeal. And the words of Joey's lawyer, the Court of Appeal exists to crush people. And the Court of Appeal were like, no, it's perfectly lawful to proscribe Palestine action. And the reasons they gave for it were just laughable. They said, why can't you just be like the suffragettes who planned everything in open and were completely transparent? The suffragettes set fire to stuff. They horsewhipped ministers. They destroyed property. They were terrorists, by if you're going to use that definition. They were terrorists. So we just got to keep fighting, and it will go up. Huda Amouri, the co-founder of Palestine Action, she's not going to let this lie. It will go to the next. It will go to the Supreme Court. And then again, it will go to the European Court of Human Rights, where, again, it's guaranteed to succeed.
Thank you for everything you shared. But there are still a lot of people in this country who don't see things the way that you do and don't recognise the connections. And how would you start a conversation with someone who sees protest as being the problem?
I think a lot of people just don't really know that the Israeli weapons trade operates in this country. And usually when I say this to someone, they're shocked. And that tends to start a different kind of conversation. And then it's just about what we do about it, I think.
I think it's really, really important to emphasise that our country is breaking the law. This government is breaking the law. So you can talk about protesters doing undesirable things. Joey would not have had to take action if our government hadn't been breaking international humanitarian law. We are signatories to the Genocide Convention. The moment there was even a sniff that genocide is plausible, as the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, says back in 2024, that's the trigger where every country who's signed that convention has to take immediate action to cut ties, to do everything, to stop sending weapons. That would be a really good start. And yet this country has carried on. So, I mean, you can say to people, you know, you don't like what activists have done. What does a person of conscience do when their government is committing war crimes? What would you do? What would you have done in occupied Germany to oppose the Nazis? These are war criminals, and we are people of conscience. I think that's where I'd start with.
I would also just say, it doesn't take everyone to make change. It takes a handful, a small handful of very brave people. And that is the thing that gives me hope as well.
Hiya. I think it must have been 2 years ago, Claire, you at Greenbelt, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
I think it was just after your daughter was arrested. It was in one of the small tents, and I just happened to hear you talking about that experience. And that really stuck with me, because you were clearly grappling in the moment with what had recently happened. And I guess it's really encouraging that you've found a way of working through that and are now being able to support others who are part of the Filton 25. And so I just wondered if you wanted to reflect at all on what in those 2 years you found helpful, poetry or otherwise, to go through that journey.
So I'm going to go all Christian on everyone. I had an extraordinary experience of preparation for what happened. So about 8 months before Joey was arrested, I became ill with post-viral fatigue, and it was really quite debilitating. I had to work from home. I had to stop doing a lot of the things that I loved and enjoyed. And it was a time of real reflection and stripping my faith and my life back to basics. With the help of the Celtic community I'm part of, I started a rhythm of prayer, daily prayer, and I began to work through a lot of inner garbage, and there was a lot of emotional healing that took place. Then one weekend, my best friend took me away on a retreat, and she said, "I'm going to pray for you to be healed, and you are going to be healed because this is enough now." And I was like, "Whatever." And she prayed for me, and I was like, "I'm going to take this. I'm just going to take this and run with it." And I didn't experience a single symptom of chronic fatigue from that day forwards. 3 days later, Joey was arrested. And I just feel that time of preparation, I actually thought about it as being taken into the desert for training. It gave me such a strong foundation. I felt loved. I felt strong. I felt secure. I believed all my heart as a God of justice and of love. And without that preparation, I think I would have fallen apart. As it was, I had 2 years. I've barely taken a day off sick. And I've had moments of real joy, actually. Which is quite hard to justify when your daughter's in prison, and moments of real stress and, you know, falling apart momentarily. But I just feel that God has been with us in the most extraordinary way. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. I wanted to go back to sort of a bit the previous question, but one, about how we can communicate these kind of issues to people who maybe have some sympathy but are sceptical, especially about people who take direct action. I feel a bit myself like that because my sister has actually very much involved in that world of direct action. I don't feel comfortable with it. And then I talk to other people, so how do I communicate with them? And what I've found is that your presentation this afternoon has been very, very good and very personal, very poetic, powerful, you know, and just speaking to me, I imagine most of the people here. And I'm just wondering, do you go around doing these kind of talks to other people? And are there other ways in which this way of presenting the message could go out more than simply big strident campaign messages?
So there's a film or slash documentary that's recently been made called Operation Recomply. It's essentially the story of everyone, not just our story. And it's had a lot of backlash. Lots of people don't want it to go out because it tells a very important story. But one thing you can do if you want to get out the message and get out the message of direct action is find a local cinema who's willing to screen it. And then maybe some of us are able to come along and talk about it. But the movie itself does a pretty good job of explaining the story.
And I'd also say just sign up to the website and just stay in touch with us. And maybe you can always request for something like this to come to where you are. Lots of the Filton guys have written poems and written zines. There are artists among them. There are other ways of communicating. So, yeah, get in touch with us. I've got one more poem to finish with, unless anyone's got any burning questions. Go for it.
Hiya. You mentioned earlier the sort of strangeness of the verdict and that two of you, including yourself, were let off. Did you get any insight into why, I guess, you were chosen, you and the other person?
Unfortunately, that would be contempt of court. And I'd rather go to prison for something more useful. But I would love to know, but I don't, unfortunately.
There's so much we could say. Dave? I belong to the most incredible church. I'm actually moved, while this has been going on, I moved from North London to East Ham to be with Bonnie Downs Baptist Church. Sally's one of the ministers. Philip is there. Dave's one of the ministers. You've never met a church like them. My previous church probably would have, I'd stopped going to it when they decided that they didn't like gay people. But probably, had I still been there when Joey had taken action, I think they would have just stopped speaking to me. Whereas Bonnie Downs just wrapped their arms around me and have been giving me the most incredible support. When, I mean, this is just a little fraction. If I just tell you, this story is a little glimpse of the things that they did. Joey was finally bailed after that first trial. And so quite late at night, Sally drove us back to our house in East Ham. And the whole house, in fact, the whole street was decorated with yellow ribbons and yellow bunting. And there was a yellow balloon arch to walk through. There were gifts on the doorstep. We opened the door and our dog had a yellow ribbon on her collar. It was just speaking to like an East End tradition about prisoner or people coming back from war. It was just, and they were just constantly bringing us food. And, you know, it's been incredible. Yeah, big hand, please, for Bonnie Downs Church. I turned up to church on Easter Sunday, and Dave, the senior minister, he's there with a T-shirt of Jesus breaking a rifle over his knee. It's like, yay, he is risen. That's what kind of church it is. Anyway, I'll just finish with a poem. I think we have run out of time. And this is something that I wrote after that very, very stressful time, after the sentencing of the Filton Four and as terrorists, and also the court's decision to uphold the proscription of Palestine Action, which we were talking about. Those happened within a few days of each other in June, and it was a very heavy few days, and it led to me writing this poem. We wake up. Sickened, shaken, in a country we no longer know. We hoped it was a dream, but everyone can see this wound across the nation's soul. And they celebrate. The warmongers, the profiteers, they celebrate the judges' broadcast jeers. We have whipped you, we have cut you, we have locked you all away. Our weapons and our profits will be safe. We peer into the chasm that the judges' words have made, to see our loved ones and the ones they are in prison for in their devastated houses and their rubble graves. How can anyone survive this pain? What can we do? How can we ever be made whole again? Then, silently and one by one, we help each other down into the gash to put our arms around their shoulders, our arms across their backs, and only then we realise how fertile is the soil down here. How well watered by the tears. How the only way to heal a nation's soul is through a forest grown from seeds planted deep within the cracks. Thanks, everyone.
Huge, huge thank you again for Claire and Joey for speaking today. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.